I read again Nehemiah chapter 1 and verse 1. The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah. And it came to pass in the month Chislew, in the 20th year, as I was in Shushan the palace. And we're looking at this book of Nehemiah, and I'd like to go through it in a series of studies. It has a lot of lessons to teach us. I'm sure that you've studied this book before and you're very familiar with it, but I don't think it would do us any harm to go through it one more time and to refresh ourselves with some of the lessons it has to learn for us as individual believers and also for us as a church serving the Lord in this part of London. Well, I'm sure you know this book of Nehemiah covers the third return of the Jews from Babylon, from Persia, back to Jerusalem, back to Judah. The very first return came in 537-538 BC, when Cyrus gave that edict tell them that they could return as soon as he took over in Babylon and had Babylon under control. One of the very first things he did was to allow that religious freedom. It wasn't only for the Jews. Sometimes when you read it, it sounds like it was only for the Jews. And the way it's put, it sounds as if almost he's a believer. He says, God has given me all the kingdoms of the world, and God has put it into my heart. God has stirred me to send back, to send you back to Jerusalem to build a house for him there. And it sounds like almost as if he's a believer, but he did that for all religions. He wasn't a one who was a monotheist. He just worshipped God, one God. He was a polytheist. He worshipped many gods. He wanted the favor of all the gods on his behalf. Anyway, that's another story. But here, King Cyrus, in 537-538 BC, he permitted those Jews to return. But of course, it was God who moved his heart. It was the Lord, because the Lord said after 70 years, then those Jews would return from Persia and Babylon. They would return back to Jerusalem. And so it was God's doing behind even that king. And that first batch, they left under Sheshbazzar. And we can read about it, or you can read about it in the first six chapters of the book of Ezra. In fact, Ezra and Nehemiah in the Hebrew Bible is actually combined together as one book. In our Bible, there are two separate books. And they cover that period of the three. There are three returns. So the first one was under Sheshbazzar. And when Sheshbazzar returned back to Jerusalem, the very first thing that he did, and those who were with him, Zerubbabel, the very first thing that they set about repairing was the temple. Well, they set up first the altar of God and offered sacrifices. And from there, they went on to lay the foundation of the temple. Very good. The worship of God is first. And that's what they know what their priorities are. They know what they need to attend. And you can read about that and the opposition they had in the first six chapters of Ezra. But then in 458 BC, a good number of years later, 70, 80 years later, a second batch of Jews are permitted to leave, this time under Ezra's leadership. And Ezra, when he returns, the thing that he sets about attending to is the reform of the people. Sheshbazzar and Zerubbabel dealt with the temple, and Ezra deals with the people of God to reform the people. Those mixed marriages had to be sorted out, but there it stopped, and there the work didn't continue. There was still a lot more to be done, and the walls needed to be rebuilt. There was still a lot of rubbish there and rubble left over in Jerusalem. And the people were just living with it in that sort of a condition. And Jerusalem was exposed to its enemies. And any one of those enemies who hated the Samaritans and those surrounding neighbors, they hated the Jews and Jerusalem. They didn't like what they saw going on in Jerusalem. And any time they could invade Jerusalem and overrun it. And so Nehemiah, in 444 BC, 14 years after Ezra went out, he leads another group, the third batch, to repair the walls and also to reform the people. In fact, the repairing of the wall didn't take very long. It only took about 55 days, they say. But the reformation of the people took a lot longer. And there's a lesson there, isn't it, already? The work, in a sense, sometimes the physical work can be done quite quickly, but the spiritual work, sanctification, takes a long time for people to change. Well, this is what we're looking at then, this book of Nehemiah. And there are so many lessons to teach us. A little bit about Nehemiah before we actually get into the text itself. Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah, he was probably, most likely he was born in Babylon during the exile itself. And it's said that he may well have been of royal descent. Some think he was of the priesthood, but maybe it's more likely that he was of a royal descent. How can we say that? Well, because at the end of this chapter, he tells us that he was the king's cupbearer. And that's not just a glorified butler. To be the king's cupbearer was a special position. It was a very privileged and honorable position. And those Oriental despots of the time, well, they liked to have royalty serving them. They didn't just want any ordinary person serving them. They liked to have royal people serving them, even the wine. So it's a very trustworthy position to give even that cup of wine to the king. So quite likely Nehemiah, like Daniel, was of royal descent. And these things took place during the reign of Artaxerxes. We read here, it happened in the 20th year, and then in chapter 2, verse 1, it's the 20th year of Artaxerxes the king. And that king, we believe, is Artaxerxes Longimanus. I hope I've pronounced that correctly. Artaxerxes Longimanus, who was the son of Xerxes. Xerxes, you remember, was the king during Esther's time. So with those sort of things in mind, just one further thing of geographical note, these things took place initially in Shushan, the palace, which was also a place where Esther and Mordecai had lived. So here we are looking at this third return of the Jews Persia, going back to Jerusalem. And my title really for today, taken from this first chapter, is The Man Whom God Uses. The man or the woman, the person God uses. And I just want to give you, from Nehemiah's life, and from this first chapter, some of the characteristics that a man of God, a woman of God, must have if they are to be useful in the Lord's kingdom. And the first characteristic, the man whom God uses, well, he must be a humble person. We see this here in verse 1. All that Nehemiah tells us about himself right at the beginning was that he was in Shushan the palace. He was one of many, one of hundreds of people, hundreds of ordinary people in the palace. It's only at the end of this chapter, the very last sentence, he tells us that he had this elevated position as the king's cupbearer. And only because the story is, as it were, needs it. The narrative needs that connection. We need to know how he had such access to the king. But he didn't flaunt his position. He didn't go around telling everyone that he was the king's cupbearer. And it suggests to us, doesn't it, that he was a very humble man. And he was a very ordinary man in his own estimate. And it's so essential for us, humility, as we've heard even recently, is so essential for our usefulness. If we lack in humility, we're lacking the ABC of Christian living. We're lacking, God cannot use us if we are lacking in humility. And if we are, if we want to give our own gifts, oh Lord, I'm in this position, and now you can use me, or, you know, I have all these gifts to be used. No, we don't put ourselves forward in a proud way, but in a humble way. Without humility, well, the Lord, in a sense, I believe, will bypass us. But when we realize that we're just ordinary people, as we do here, and nothing special, but Lord is with us, then he uses us. So the first thing is that humility. The second thing, as it's so obvious here, a man of God who's to be used of God must have a deep concern for the church. Here we see in verse 2 that Hanani, one of the brethren, came, he and certain men of Judah. I believe this is one of his real brethren, his real brothers. In chapter 7, verse 2, we see that. He refers to him as his brother. And he and certain men of Judah came, and he asked them about the state of the Jews that had returned, and those who had left of the captivity, and concerning Jerusalem. He's concerned. His brother, for some reason, has been to Judah. We don't know why he went to Judah. He's now returned. He will soon return again with Nehemiah in the future days. Just a side point. It's interesting, if indeed these two are brothers, then they must have had godly parents. They must have had parents who taught them. They're brought up in Babylon. They're brought up in a land very far away from their home. And yet their parents must have instilled in them or reminded them and told them about Jerusalem and something of what it was like. And the religion of the Jews, of course, would have been instilled in these people, a love for Israel's and Israel's God. So these are true Jews. They have, even though they have never been, it seems, as far as we know, to Jerusalem, they had a concern for it. They had a love for it. And so we see here that they reported back to Nehemiah, "The remnant that I left of the captivity there in the province are in great affliction and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem also is broken down, and the gates thereof are burned with fire." And he basically is saying that the people, well, they're in great distress, and they're suffering great reproach. The neighboring peoples, well, they are treating the Jews with scorn and contempt. And it's a dangerous situation that those people are in. They're in a weak position. And the walls also are in a terrible state. The walls have been broken down. They were not completely destroyed. They were broken down. But they were left in the same way as when Nebuchadnezzar had invaded the city and broken it down at that time. And was left in that state, unrepaired, all those many years. And Nehemiah is concerned. And as we said, the place itself, Jerusalem, was piled with rubbish. So there was a work to be done. There was things to be done, things to be attended to. And Nehemiah knew about it. And we could also say, there's always something to be done in the church, isn't there? There's always areas in the church which needs attention. Sometimes, at one point for them, it was the temple, then it was the people, and now it's the walls of Jerusalem. And the church of God, well, it's always going to need some attention. It's never perfect. There's always some area that needs to be restored or reformed to be seen to. So there's always a need, friends, for workers in the church of God. There's never going to be a perfect church in this world. The Lord's always going to be in need of workers to help within the church and to reach out to other people. Unfortunately, it seems, many of the people who were in Jerusalem at that time had fallen into some kind of apathy and were leaving things as it was. But anyway, here we see that Nehemiah, when he heard these things, verse 4, he sat down and wept and mourned certain days and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. His response is amazing. He feels for his city. He feels for the people who are there in the state that is there. He weeps. Here is this grown man, this man with such a noble position, and yet his heart is so tender towards the things of God, and as it were, the church of God, we could say. And he is concerned, and he weeps over and mourns, not just for a temporary time, but for certain days, for a number of days. This is no passing phase, no emotional phase that he just has that lasts for 5 minutes. This is something deep that he is tremendously concerned about. And it seems it's as if he's burdened with it. He recalls what he's heard from his parents, maybe, about the days of glory. Or he's read in the scriptures about King David and Solomon, and how Jerusalem was a place where of such glory at those times. And its greatest king, King David, its wisest king, King Solomon. But look at it now. Look at its state now. And these things troubled him greatly. And the only way he could find relief was in praying to God and unburdening his heart to God. The Apostle Paul was also similar. In Romans 9:2, he said, "I have great heaviness and continual sorrow in my heart for the people of Israel." He was concerned for their salvation. And here he's carrying within his bosom deep feelings of heaviness because they were rejecting Christ. Well, so friends, even for us, if we desire to be used of the Lord, well, then we too must have a deep concern for the kingdom of Christ, for the church of Jesus Christ. A deep concern for God's glory and for God's name. We distressed and burdened, we should feel something that when we look at the church, it's not as powerful as it used to be. It's had its glory days, especially in the Acts and the early church, and in different periods of history, it's had its glory days. But sometimes we look at it now and we are saddened by what we see. Devoid of power, a social club, many of them have become, or in many cases it's become a formal religion. We just read the Evangelical Times and, you know, every month you see something that makes you shocked. You know, just this month's edition, I think, was referring to the goings on with the evangelical or the church in Wales, and all sorts of different things which are taking place within the kingdom of God, which surprises. And so the unbeliever ridicules the church. He laughs at the church. It's not like in the times of the Acts where he's afraid to join the church, but now he can laugh at it and mocks it. And these things should concern us. Or perhaps we could think as well of the churches, so many churches which are closing down to help us to feel something for the church. Think of a church, maybe you know it's, if you know, can go back, find out about its history, you'll find maybe about 100 years ago or 50 years ago, many people were going to that church. That church was full and people were delighting to hear the gospel preached in that church. And they were delighting to go and learn the word every Lord's Day. And the pews were full. But then, now you look at it today, and sadly, it's empty. And all these, and maybe the building is being sold off. Being sold off to Hindus or Muslims, or being sold off to furniture warehouses. And it's sad when we see these things happening. And so these things should move us and stir us. As we think of them, it will help us to increase our concern for the church. but I must move on. The third of 7 points that I have here, or seven characteristics, is the man who is to be used of God, well, he must be dependent on God for blessing. Verse 4, again, Nehemiah turned to God in prayer. This was the first thing he did. He already had it in his heart to do something for God. He already wanted to do something, but instead of just concocting his own plan and then praying to God to bless it, he first turns to the Lord in prayer. And he asks for God to intervene and to have mercy and for God to work providentially. And I'm sure if it was his will, that he would be pleased to use him. And that's what we are to do also. We bring all our projects before God, prayer first, and then put ourselves into action. Dependence upon God, realizing that without him, well, we can do nothing. We can achieve nothing that is deep and lasting. God must work. God must open the doors. God must bring people in. And God must use us. And so prayer and dependence on God for blessing is the third thing. Fourthly, we must have an awareness of God's greatness. In verse 5, he begins his prayer, I beseech thee, O Lord God of heaven, the great and terrible God, that keepeth covenant and mercy for them that love him and observe his commandments. The great and terrible God, the awesome God. He has this high view of God. He begins his prayer with great reverence for the Lord. And this is lost sight of today. In a day when people are talking overmuch, maybe, or only emphasizing on God's love, which of course we believe in and rejoice in, thankful for, but we must also remember that God is a great and majestic and a terrible God, an awesome God, and not bring him down to our level, not speak to him as if he's just one of us, as if he's just our next door neighbor. The kings of the earth are spoken to, it seems, with more respect sometimes than the way people speak to God. But the believer, well, he must know his God and have a sense, even in his heart, of his majesty, of his power, and have a great reverence for him. But then the fifth characteristic from Nehemiah's life, he had here a sense of the sinfulness of sin. In verses 6 and 7, he makes a confession to God of Israel's sin, of his family's sin. At the end of verse 6, I and my father's house have sinned, and his own sin. We have dealt very corruptly against thee, and have not kept thy commandments, and so on, he says. We've treated your commandments very lightly, and that has dishonored you. That's the reason why we're in the mess we are. That's the reason why we landed up in Persia. Is all because of our sin against you, and you had to bring that judgment upon us because we so dishonored you. So friends, the one whom God uses also doesn't treat sin lightly. He doesn't make excuses for it. He doesn't minimize it. No, he sees sin as that offense against a holy and wonderful God, and deserving of punishment. Sixthly, he has faith in God. Not only does he confess his sin, but he also rehearses before God in verse 8 the promise that God had made. God had said, if you transgress, I'll scatter you, but if you turn unto me, verse 9, then I will gather you wherever you are, from whatever parts of the earth you are, I will gather you back again to Jerusalem. I think this is taken from Deuteronomy 30. And Nehemiah pleads this promise before God. And he knows God's character. He knows that God is faithful to his word. God keeps his word. He knows that God keeps his promises. He knows that God hears prayer and that he responds to prayer. And so he mixes with his prayer faith, expecting God to use him, expecting God to open a door, expecting God to do something. He knows that God can change the situation. And of course we must be men and women of faith. And then one final thing, the man, the woman whom God uses to say here is self-sacrificial. Nehemiah, at the end of this verse, in verse 11, he says, "For I was the king's cupbearer." It was a good position to hold. It was a very comfortable position for him. Financially, he would have been well off. He would have been very comfortable in life, and he could carry on living very comfortably in Shushan the palace and not have to worry about anything else. But look, he's willing to sacrifice his comforts and to place himself in a position of trouble. He's willing to exchange the palace and his comfy job there for toil, for trouble, for discomfort, for opposition in Jerusalem. And all those things he's going to face. It's going to be a wearisome journey, 1,000 miles, just to leave, to go from Shushan all the way back to Jerusalem. That in itself is weary, but doing the work, and then facing the opposition, and then facing the unkindnesses of people even there. Well, he's willing to sacrifice these comforts for the Lord's sake, for the Lord's glory. This is how he desires to live. And a believer who wishes to be used of the Lord, well, they must be prepared as well to forego some of the comforts of life. Maybe it's time. Maybe it's money. Maybe it's hard work. Maybe it's doing things in a hidden way without being rewarded for it. Or maybe the work is going to be very tiring that God gives that person to do. But we are to continue to labor and to sow the seed, not paying too much regard or overmuch regard to ourselves, but having the Lord's kingdom ever in our hearts. So, dear friends, this is my message for today, that even though the majority of the Jews who were in Babylon maybe were unconcerned about Jerusalem, maybe indifferent towards them, yet here was Nehemiah, who was of a different spirit, and there were others who were also with him. And I just remind you of these characteristics which he had and which we seek for: humility, a deep concern for the prosperity of the church, a dependence on God, and a desire for his glory, a sight of his majesty, the sense or sight of the evil of sin, faith in the Lord, and a willingness to put up with difficulties and hardships for the Lord's sake. Amen. Lord, make these words a help to us.